About halfway between West Egg and New York, the motor road hastily joins the railroad and runs beside it for a quarter of a mile, so as to shrink away from a certain desolate area of land. This is a valley of ashes, a fantastic farm where ashes grow like wheat into ridges and hills. Occasionally a line of gray cars crawls along an invisible track, gives out a ghastly creak, and comes to rest, and immediately ash-gray men swarm up with leaden spades and stir up an impenetrable cloud which screens their obscure operations from your sight. But above the gray land and the spasms of bleak dust which drift endlessly over it, you perceive, after a moment, the eyes of Dr. T.J. Eckelberg. The eyes of Dr. T.J. Eckelberg are blue and gigantic. Their retinas are 1 yard high. They look out of no face, but, instead, from a pair of enormous yellow spectacles which pass over a non-existent nose, dimmed a little by many paintless days under sun and rain, they brood on over the solemn dumping ground. The Valley of Ashes is bounded on one side by a small foul river and, when the drawbridge is up to let barges through, the passengers on waiting trains can stare at the dismal scene for as long as half an hour. There is always a halt there of at least a minute, and it was because of this that I first met Tom Buchanan's mistress. I went up to New York with Tom on the train one afternoon, and when we stopped by the ash heaps, he jumped to his feet and, taking hold of my elbow, literally forced me from the car. "We're getting off," he insisted. "I want you to meet my girl." I followed him over a low, whitewashed railroad fence, and we walked back 100 yards along the road under Dr. Eckelberg's persistent stare. The only building in sight was a small block of yellow brick, contiguous to absolutely nothing. One of the three shops it contained was a garage. "Repairs. George B. Wilson. Cars bought and sold." And I followed Tom inside. The interior was unprosperous and bare. The only car visible was the dust-covered wreck of a Ford which crouched in a dim corner. It had occurred to me that this shadow of a garage must be a blind, and that sumptuous and romantic apartments were concealed overhead, when the proprietor himself appeared in the door of an office, wiping his hands on a piece of waste. He was a blond, spiritless man, anemic and faintly handsome. When he saw us, a damp gleam of hope sprang into his light blue eyes.
"Hello, Wilson, old man," said Tom, slapping him jovially on the shoulder. "How's business?"
"I can't complain," answered Wilson unconvincingly. "When are you going to sell me that car?"
"Next week. I've got my man working on it now."
I heard footsteps on the stairs, and in a moment the thickish figure of a woman blocked out the light from the office door. She was in the middle 30s. She smiled slowly and, walking through her husband as if he were a ghost, shook hands with Tom, looking him flush in the eye. Without turning around, she said,
"Get some chairs, why don't you, so somebody can sit down."
"Oh, sure," agreed Wilson, and he went toward the little office. His wife moved close to Tom.
"I want to see you," said Tom. "Get on the next train."
"All right. I'll meet you by the newsstand on the lower level." We waited for her down the road and out of sight.
"Terrible place, isn't it?" said Tom. "It does her good to get away."
"Doesn't her husband object?"
"Wilson? He thinks she goes to see her sister in New York. He's so dumb he doesn't know he's alive."
So Tom Buchanan and his girl and I went up together to New York. Or not quite together, for Mrs. Wilson sat discreetly in another car. Tom deferred that much to the sensibilities of those East Eggers who might be on the train. In New York, she let 4 taxicabs drive away before she selected a new one, lavender-colored with gray upholstery. And in this we slid out from the mass of the station into the glowing sunshine. We drove over to Fifth Avenue, warm and soft, almost pastoral, on the summer Sunday afternoon. "Hold on," I said. "I have to leave you here."
"No, you don't," interposed Tom. "Myrtle'll be hurt if you don't come up to the apartment. Won't you, Myrtle?"
"Come on," she urged. "I'll telephone my sister Catherine. She's said to be very beautiful by people who ought to know."
At 158th Street, the cab stopped at one slice in a long white cake of apartment houses. The apartment was on the top floor. The living room was crowded with a set of tapestried furniture entirely too large for it, so that to move about was to stumble over ladies swinging in the gardens of Versailles. Several old copies of Town Tattle lay on the table, together with some of the scandal magazines of Broadway. Tom brought out a bottle of whiskey from a locked bureau door.
"I've been drunk just twice in my life, and the second time was that afternoon. So everything that happened has a dim, hazy cast over it, although until after 8 o'clock the apartment was full of cheerful sun. Sitting on Tom's lap, Mrs. Wilson called up several people on the telephone. Then there were no cigarettes, and I went out to buy some at the drugstore on the corner. When I came back, they had both disappeared, so I sat down discreetly in the living room. Just as Tom and Myrtle reappeared, company commenced to arrive at the apartment door. The sister, Catherine, was a slender, worldly girl of about 30, with a solid, sticky bob of red hair and a complexion powdered milky white. When she moved about, there was an incessant clicking as innumerable pottery bracelets jingled up and down upon her arms. Mr. Chester McKee was a pale, feminine man from the flat below. He had just shaved, for there was a white spot of lather on his cheekbone. I gathered later that he was a photographer and had made the dim enlargement of Mrs. Wilson's mother, which hovered like an ectoplasm on the wall. His wife was shrill, languid, handsome, and horrible.
"I've done some nice things out on Long Island," asserted Mr. McKee.
Tom looked at him blankly.
"Two of them we have framed downstairs."
"To what?" demanded Tom.
"Two studies."
The sister Catherine sat down beside me on the couch.
"Do you live down on Long Island, too?"
"I live at West Egg."
"Really? I was down there at a party about a month ago, at a man named Gatsby's. Do you know him?"
"I live next door to him."
"Well, they say he's a nephew or a cousin of Kaiser Wilhelm's. That's where all his money comes from."
"Really?" This absorbing information about my neighbor was interrupted by Mrs. McKee's pointing suddenly at Catherine.
"Chester, I think you could do something with her."
But Mr. McKee only nodded in a bored way and turned his attention to Tom.
"I'd like to do more work on Long Island, if I could get the entry. All I ask is that they should give me a start."
"Ask Myrtle," said Tom, as Mrs. Wilson entered with a tray. "She'll give you a letter of introduction, won't you, Myrtle?"
"Do what?" she asked. "You'll give McKee a letter of introduction to your husband, so he can do some studies of him. George B. Wilson at the gasoline pump, or something like that."
Catherine leaned close to me and whispered in my ear,
"Neither of them can stand the person they're married to."
"Can't they?" She looked at Myrtle and then at Tom.
"What I say is, why go on living with them if they can't stand them? If I was them, I'd get a divorce and then get married to each other right away."
"Doesn't she like Wilson either?" The answer to this was unexpected. It came from Myrtle, who had overheard the question, and it was violent and obscene.
"You see,"
cried Catherine. She lowered her voice again.
"It's really Tom's wife that's keeping them apart. She's a Catholic, and they don't believe in divorce."
Daisy was not a Catholic, and I was a little shocked at the elaborateness of the lie.
"When they do get married," continued Catherine, "they're going west to live for a while until it blows over. And Myrtle really ought to get away from Wilson. They've been living over that garage for 11 years, and Tom's the first sweetie she ever had."
The bottle of whiskey, a second one, was now in constant demand by all present, excepting Catherine, who felt just as good on nothing at all. Tom rang for the janitor and sent him for some celebrated sandwiches, which were a complete supper in themselves. I wanted to get out and walk eastward toward the park through the soft twilight, but each time I tried to go, I became entangled in some wild, strident argument, which pulled me back, as if with ropes, into my chair. Yet high over the city our line of yellow windows must have contributed their share of human secrecy to the casual watcher in the darkening streets. And I saw him, too, looking up and wondering. I was within and without, simultaneously enchanted and repelled by the inexhaustible variety of life. It was 9 o'clock. Almost immediately afterward, I looked at my watch and found it was 10. Mr. McKee was asleep on a chair with his fists clenched in his lap, like a photograph of a man of action. Taking out my handkerchief, I wiped from his cheek the spot of dried lather that had worried me all the afternoon. People disappeared, reappeared, made plans to go somewhere, and then lost each other, searched for each other, found each other a few feet away. Sometime toward midnight, Tom Buchanan and Mrs. Wilson stood face to face discussing, in impassioned voices, whether Mrs. Wilson had any right to mention Daisy's name. "Daisy! Daisy! Daisy!" shouted Mrs. Wilson. "I'll say it whenever I want to. Daisy! Making a short, deft movement, Tom Buchanan broke her nose with his open hand. Then there were bloody towels upon the bathroom floor and women's voices scolding, and high over the confusion, a long, broken wail of pain. Mr. McKee awoke from his doze and started in a daze toward the door. When he had gone halfway, he turned around and stared at the scene. His wife and Catherine scolding and consoling as they stumbled here and there among the crowded furniture with articles of aid, and the despairing figure on the couch, bleeding fluently, and trying to spread a copy of Town Tattle over the tapestry scenes of Versailles. Then Mr. McKee turned and continued on out the door. Taking my hat from the chandelier, I followed. Then I was lying half asleep in the cold lower level of the Pennsylvania Station, staring at the Morning Tribune and waiting for the 4 o'clock train.